This special NABFX podcast is made possible in part by the support of GenArts, creators of the Sapphire plugins, the essential VFX toolkit for digital artists. Swing by booth SL2829 for a demo of Sapphire on Autodesk Systems, Avid, and After Effects, or visit www.genarts.com for more information. This podcast is also made possible in part by SohoNet. SohoNet is the largest high-bandwidth connector for the global entertainment industry, delivering secure, high-speed connectivity to major media companies across Europe, the U.S., and Australasia. SohoNet also provides complete technology consulting on all digital workflow issues.
Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Ron Brinkman, who many of your listeners will know about from his Nothing Real and Apple days, is come along to be an advisor to the Foundry to help look at all our products, but in particular our work on Nuke and Furnace and our other high-end products.
Wow. Now, that was okay. Bill Collis from the Foundry with some big news today, man.
Yeah, well, in light of everything we discussed yesterday in the podcast. That's really huge news. I mean, we're all kind of speculating about the potential that Nuke has, and Ron being such a big force in the compositing industry, it really speaks volumes for them to say that he's, you know, advising them on upcoming products and features.
Yeah, I gotta say, those of you, you know, who know Shake, like, you know, Tal here does, of course, you know, and from Ron's book, his background in production, and Nothing Real, that he's just really the kind of person you want to have involved in building your software, and you know, talking to him today as well, he's really excited moving forward and looking into that. I mean, they've got some good plans. They have a new version coming out in May or very soon, right?
It will ship soon. Yeah. They were showing the alpha on the floor, and I managed to speak briefly to Bill Spitzak, who I think I mentioned the other day, and he said that, you know, customers should be expecting it soon, but there wasn't an actual date as such.
You know, we should probably say who we are while we're at this. I'm Jeff Fuser.
I'm Tal Naran.
John Montgomery.
And Paul Roskus.
We kind of had to do that little announcement there first, but yeah. I thought people were probably going, who are all these
people?
We're
taking it a little bit easier here on the last day. And Mike Seymour is already on the plane back to Sydney, having to get back there.
It's so weird not having Mike here.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It is. But in addition to that, yeah, and after they get this, you know, 4.7 version out, and the Foundry is also going to be moving all the Furnace plugins to OFX, all of the Tinder plugins as well to OFX. You know, right now it's only a limited set of those at this point in time, and that's going to be really critical within Nuke to have that happening, that first compatibility. And then in the coming months, they're just going to kind of start to plan out what they're going to be looking at in the coming months and what they're going to look at biting off first and changing within Nuke. And probably one of those things is the UI, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was funny. I spoke to Bill and I sort of asked him a couple of questions about that. And everything that was like the things that are talked about, the UI and other features that people are discussing, wouldn't it be great if this was fixed? They seem to be really aware of what the customers want. So it's suggesting that they're really on the pulse of what the clients want it to be developed. So yeah, as we keep saying, it's going to be great to see what comes out.
And that's the thing about the Foundry. I think they've kind of got that reputation for having really good support and listening to their customers. Being a smaller company, I think that's easier.
In,
but I think that's why people are excited about this news.
You know, yesterday I meant to say this and I didn't get a chance. The wrap on Nuke with the GUI, the user interface being so lame. It's not lame, but you know, just minimal compared to other applications. You know, that we did a story and I went over and saw a pretty in-depth demo a few years ago on it, and I remember them specifically pointing out they did that on purpose. They wanted it to be super low overhead. They wanted it to be any computer in the building, they could open it on and work effectively on it. So they didn't want to clog it up with a lot of shiny icons that glowed when you touched them and things like that. So of course, obviously, computers have gotten fast enough now that should be not a problem. But so I think people are looking forward to something a little more elegant, but yeah, it was done kind of on purpose, from what I understand.
Yeah, no, and look, it makes sense. And I know a lot of people who use it every day. I've spoken to some digital domain guys and they have no problem whatsoever with it. They really like it. I think it's just one of those accessibility things. I mean, and looking at interfaces, I still think that Flame has the best interface. It's a bit sort of difficult to navigate, but the way that it keeps the footage windows clean and all the tools down the bottom is just such a brilliant thing. And it really, when you're looking at a really experienced FFR user, they just rip through that application so fast. And I think it's in a large part because of the way it's all laid out.
Yeah, and we talked yesterday about the acceptance of that by the artists who've worked at Digital Domain, how much they love Nuke. And I think the UI thing will kind of reflect in people taking a look at it for the first time, you know, because you do have that kind of perception when you get that first demo that's like, whoa, this is not quite as the same as other applications.
Sure, I remember sitting through the first demo originally, you know, I'm a Mac guy. I kind of, in my personal life, I've kind of used to that, and sitting down going, okay. And I remember by the end of the demo going, okay, it does not matter in the least. The powerful stuff they were doing back then. So,
yeah, exactly. Well, when I was at the booth, I got a little bit more information from Bill Collis about Ron and his involvement. And Ron was there as well, so I talked to him. So kind of what's the plan moving forward in working with Ron then?
We just really want him to bring his production expertise and his expertise with this software to have a really good look at a Nuke, for example, in the way it's used and the way artists can really use it to make it a really, really good product. And we just really value his experience in helping steer the development of it over the coming years.
So, Ron, what drew you to work with the Foundry on this?
I think it's the combination of, I think it's really nice to have not only the technology of the Foundry plugins and stuff, but now being able to put that into a full application itself. Because, you know, when you're dealing with something that's plugins, sometimes it's harder to get it integrated as well as you want, to have it be part of the natural workflow all the way through. We've seen that with, certainly, you know, with the Shake stuff as well. And so it's really exciting to see you've got, you know, Nuke as a compositing application, and then putting all of this really rocket scientist technology throughout the application as well. So I think that's a good thing, you know. And it's a great group of people. I mean, I've been working with the Foundry for, you know, more years than I can count now. And I know everybody here, and I know how respected they are in the industry. So it seems like a really good mix to kind of stick my fingers in and throw it around a little bit.
So people who know you and have read the stuff, and actually you've got a new book coming out soon, but know that you're really interested in the super high end, and this does provide that opportunity for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that has always sort of been my focus, is the high end. You know, visual effects, film production is where I came out of, and that's still where I think the interesting stuff is going on. That's where the technology is being pushed and the boundaries are being stretched a little bit. So to be able to focus on that, and that's really what the Foundry is focusing on too as well. So it's good. You know, it's more of a niche market, but that's sort of what makes it exciting, is, you know, you can be sort of lighter on your feet and just really react to stuff and stay on top of the technology.
I'm sure also when you were at Apple, you were probably aware of what was going on with Nuke, just in the evaluation process and looking at it and thinking about that. And it's got to be kind of interesting now to kind of take some of that and go, you know, it would be really interesting if it did this.
Yeah, it's exciting to get to play in somebody else's toolbox, you know. It's a whole different way of looking at things in some cases, but that's only good. It gives you a different perspective on stuff. So, you know, Nuke is obviously a proven, battle-tested piece of software. So, you know, you can only get better. It's great.
Well, that's big news. I guess I'd have to say, in my opinion, the buzz on the floor just in general in our area has probably been Nuke and the Red Camera. Those two seem to be the big...
A little bit of the Apple, the Final Cut.
Oh, the Apple. Yeah, of course. Of course.
That thing, you know.
The biggest booth.
Yeah. I posted a picture. Actually, there's a whole bunch of pictures I'm posting for this story that goes along with this podcast on the webpage. There's a picture of the Apple booth on day one from coming down the escalators overhead that I put up that's got...
I think you can see it on Google Earth.
But I did appreciate the fact that they had a sitting area. I thought that was a nice touch. The Apple sponsored
lounge. The lounge. So, yeah. Paul, man, this is your first visit to the podcast studios. This is Paul Roskus from Summer Assault in Chicago.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Yeah. What do you find interesting on the show floor? What have you guys been looking at?
Well, in addition to, you know, the Red Camera, which I'm sure has been discussed ad nauseum.
To death.
Okay. We won't talk about that right now. One thing that... I was looking at heavily this year was critical viewing monitors. It's kind of an area that, you know, isn't as sexy as Red or Nuke announcements or Final Cut Studio, but I feel it's, you know, really important that we be looking at the best possible quality images we can, especially in color correction and graphics. And it seemed like the big story this year was LED backlit monitors. Sony, eCinema Systems, and another little company less known called TV Logic all were showing LED backlit monitors in their booths. The Sony one you could hardly get to. It was pretty much packed. You know, they should have had a much larger area so the hordes could get through and check out what they've been working on. But, you know, that seems to be the way things are going to replace CRTs. You know, everybody's been looking at these CRTs for decades now.
And you're talking about the broadcast monitor.
Yeah, broadcast quality monitors. And, you know, they look really good. Of course, there is a price to be paid right. for that kind of quality. Right now, the I'm trying to remember the 40-inch eCinema, I think, was... I think they had a show special, $43,000 for that one.
Yeah. You know,
and
I love a good quality monitor, but we're reaching the real weird turning point where, you know, there's not going to be any at home ever.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I know three major facilities in L.A., and I think it's a growing trend that, I mean, Panasonic plasmas on the wall.
Yeah, you guys just moved Paul to a new, really nice new facility on Michigan Avenue, currently old place.
Yeah, and we needed new client monitors and HD monitors in our suites, and what we decided to do was go with the Panasonic 50-inch plasmas.
That's...
They produce a really nice image, good black levels. The only problem that I've run into is SD material scaled on those monitors can look kind of ragged, so we still have the little 20-inch Sony monitors next to them, so I can, you know, show clients that, you know, the really standard F material still looks as good as they expect it to. Mm. But the HD stuff looks beautiful on them. But, you know, once again, for our color correction room right now, we're using an older Sony tube monitor, which produces absolutely gorgeous image. But it's, you know, we just retubed it last summer at about a $20,000 cost, and we don't want to have to do that again. So hopefully in the next year or two, technology will allow us to replace that with probably an LED backlit monitor that's capable of, you know, producing the quality that we need.
Do we have a price idea on those? I mean, I'm really just questioning in everyday suites and day in and day out. I mean, are we done paying that much money for monitors?
That's a really good question. It's hard to say. I think for color correction, especially if you're going back to film and you need a monitor that you can calibrate and depend on that calibration, you know, I think the current standard backlit LCD technology isn't quite up to that. But I think eventually, you know, as mass production on the LED backlit monitors ramps up, prices will drop. You know,
I mean, also it does depend. I mean, it's so. I do remember years ago, I'm pretty sure this is a true story, maybe urban legend, that in New York, color facilities started using some brand of monitor. Maybe it was the Sony's, and they'd been using other ones before that, and it really, like, the whole town had to change. Everybody, because clients would leave color and go, "Well, it doesn't look as good as that."
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't look like it did in the color correction suite. So now all of a sudden it's like, you trace back the problem, it's like, oh, well, that monitor looks completely different, has a different feel. I think it was back in the days of Shibasuko or something like that was the monitor.
And another interesting issue with the LCD technology is being able to see interlaced
big problem.
Problems.
Big.
I mean, granted, you know, most people going out to Circuit City right now and buying flat panel plasmas or LCDs are going to experience, you know, deinterlaced images at home. But it's still important, I think, right now to have at least one CRT in your facility so that you can, you know, have some quality assurance as far as, you know, are the fields correct and are they being dealt with correctly?
Especially in North America.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, that's a huge issue actually motion graphics-wise. I mean, I know several people, including myself, who've kind of gotten bagged by that, you know, not being able to see that and see what it looks like on the plasma screen, and it really really makes things difficult, and there's not a good solution out there. So,
but once again, I saw some technology today that, you know, could make this kind of a non-issue in the future. I was by the Terranex booth, and they showed an example of deinterlacing from Final Cut Pro from the Kona 2 card and then using their converter deinterlacer, and it was actually doing a beautiful job of deinterlacing the image. I mean, compared to other...
Are you talking for inside of a TV set chip type thing? Or?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this was like basically a standards converter. You know, you can run your standard def image, interlaced image through it, and get out a progressive, you know, up-converted high-def image. And I think deinterlacing technology is going to, you know, kind of help ease the transition to hopefully an all progressive image world in the future. But
yeah, very,
we'll see.
Yeah, very true. Now, you were also talking earlier about wandering by the CME booth. Check out some of their stuff with the wiretap. I mean, we were talking earlier in the week about this explosion wiretap products. And this product was actually, I think, introduced first last year, right? And now they're finally about ready to ship it.
That's correct, yes. And, I mean, the first thing that jumped out at me, last year they were showing a, basically, I think they were only doing a Windows-only client where they would create a virtual AVI file that would access the material on Stone. This year, now they support Mac OS as well. So they can create virtual QuickTime files. And one thing, I didn't get a chance to see it demoed, but they were talking about basically being able to move material and metadata using XML between Final Cut and Smoke. So I think they're keeping, you know, soft clips, you know, between the two timelines, all the metadata, time code, everything intact, yeah. Which is a really interesting feature.
It's funny that we've got a clip with him. John and I went and visited Adam Burke over there. We probably should just listen to that. But I mean, that's one thing they were really proud of is that, you know, they're not just making QuickTimes. They're actually giving access to the frame store, moving between versions. So if you've got a Flame version 9 and a 2007 machine that you mm-hmm. can't wire between, yeah. they can move it across and keep the metadata. That's huge.
And it's interesting. They told me, I'm pretty sure that this is true, but that it's basically a one-hop transfer. It's just controlling the devices, but transferring over whatever network fabric you're using. At our facility, we have all of our discrete products on InfiniBand right now, and I love it. It's just crazy fast.
How is that?
We're moving HD in real time between rooms. SD is about 5 times real time, so it really allows us to get things back and forth much quicker. Eventually, we're going to put InfiniBand, hopefully, on our base light color correction system, so we can ingest, you know, go to a completely tapeless workflow, ingest material and conform directly from the base light DPX files. So it's really going to make things go a lot smoother.
Yeah. At the user group, they were showing a bunch of stuff on InfiniBand, and the numbers they were pushing through looked amazing. I mean, they're pushing through like these long file sequences, like, was it like 9,000-10,000 frames? And it was just tearing through them really, really fast.
Yeah.
So it looked really impressive.
Yeah, and it's really all the changes that they made in the wiretap stuff has really opened it up. You can see what they're doing with the open, you know, file system support and things like that. And it's between the wiretap applications that are out there, like Untap, right, is one of them, the Tiger Technology one.
The Alan Lattery we talked to him about the pool, shrink it.
Yeah. And
Tether, yes.
And Tether and this app. But this app is a little bit deeper, as we found out, I think. It's a little bit deeper, a little more feature-rich as from a facility standpoint. And those other apps.
Yeah, we'll play the interview now, but after today, we recorded this yesterday, actually, and today he called me and said that they were doing demos on the booth of actually opening up a Final Cut timeline, multi-layer timeline, and sending it directly to Smoke, and just there.
That's amazing.
With CME, we're able to fill a large gap in need for infrastructure and media management in the background without interrupting artists or without interrupting suites and be able to do things really quickly and easily, like transfer media from Stone to Stone with complete version independence while at the same time allowing the cool little things like QuickTime and AVI, import and export, anything that'll open and play on the master CME machine, you can upload or download.
Well, let's talk about the kind of individual parts of this and start maybe with some of the virtual QuickTime stuff. Why don't you talk about what the virtual QuickTime capability gives you on both the Mac and the PC?
Okay, well, the virtual QuickTime and virtual AVIs allow you to use media that lives on a Stone inside your desktop applications on Macs and PCs, such as Premiere Pro, After Effects, Final Cut Pro, Shake, things of that nature, without actually physically copying or transferring any of the uncompressed frames from the Stone. You're able to access them directly.
So effectively on your Mac or PC, you have a pointer to the Stone FS, but it looks like a QuickTime movie to the applications?
Yeah, exactly. Or an AVI, either one. So I guess the next step would be to talk about Stone-to-Stone transfer. And like I said, we're able to transfer media from Stone-to-Stone with complete version independence. So that means an example of that would be to if you have an effects room that's running a Flame 2007 while the same project is being onlined in a room that's running Smoke 7 or Smoke 675, you're able to have full read-write compatibility between those systems and be able to do it all in the background really fast without ever interrupting anyone.
Yeah, well, now one of the interesting things setting up these special libraries and special reels on your Inferno, Flame, or Smoke systems and how they work. Essentially, you can set up a DVD, FTP, or email reel. And why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Okay, well, basically on every system, you would simply have a CME project that would have separate reels for basically anything you'd want to do, such as create a DVD, upload to an FTP, send an email, or anything like that. You're able to just save a clip into that reel, and CME will take care of the rest.
So let's say you wanted to send something to me, johnmon@effectsguide.com. I mean, what would you do when you're sitting in Flame, essentially?
You'd inside of Flame, you'd simply prepare your clip and save it into the email reel with the proper comments and the clip name, and everything would be taken care of. And all the preferences for how you want to go about sending that or whatever are set within the CME user interface. But something I'd really like to mention that I think is really important, even more important than this stuff, is the workflows we're developing for metadata translation and being able to retain metadata while transferring metadata and media between platforms and other systems, even systems other than Autodesk systems. For example, I mean, I can take something I've captured and edited in Final Cut and upload consolidated media from Final Cut with an XML and basically be able to conform a Final Cut timeline without ever even thinking about having to go back to tapes or anything like that. And be able to go back the other way, too. We're able to translate QuickTime and AVI timecode tracks and key code through DPX and other things like that. So it's really more than just a simple QuickTime or AVI I/O system. It's really something that you can use to change the way that you manage your media and infrastructure in the background.
I think it's interesting because this software is actually developed in a post facility, real-world workflow. And one of the things that we were looking at earlier was this really easy ability to create a DVD from within Flame. I mean, how would you go about doing that? Say I've finished a spot in Flame and I want a DVD burned of it.
Well, you could either do it from CME or simply save the clip to the DVD reel in the CME project. But inside of CME, what CME has the capability to do is within the user interface, you can select any clip anywhere, no matter what the resolution, and click one button and it will encode, format, and burn a DVD. And that uses the resolution independence of DVD burning is based around a really high quality multiprocessor aware super bicubic filtering. So it's a really high quality scaling of, you know, it's very easy to say you have a music video that's finished in 1080p or 2K. You can simply just select the final clip, hit one button, and it'll burn a DVD with time code or key code overlays, any other kind of text overlays and watermarking or a bug with transparency and all that stuff. So it's handy.
So you've got the DVD reel, you've got the FTP reel, you've got the email reel. Let's say you want to send me a clip, johnmon@effectsguide.com, that's sitting on your Flame desktop. I mean, how would you do that?
Well, I mean, it can work multiple different ways, but for a simple example, you could maybe just name the clip, send to John at johnmon@effectsguide.com, and save it in the email reel of the CME project, and CME will take care of the rest from there. Works very similar on the other side of things as well. You can access media that lives on the stone through the virtual AVIs and QuickTimes, and then be able to render out to a similar type of watch folder situation. So things will be uploaded into the proper reels on the proper stone in the proper project, all automatically.
So now there are quite a few programs out there. There's Tiger Technology has something that acts as WireTap. There's OnTap that does that. You know, in kind of a summary, what sets your product apart from those?
Well, we don't look at our product, like I said, as a simple media or QuickTime I/O tool, and we don't look at it as just a viewing and approval tool. We're approaching CME and the development of CME as a scalable tool set that can go from handling your simple QuickTime I/O and DVD creation all the way up to a full media and infrastructure management tool set that can handle, you know, all sorts of media management. Like I said, the version independent stone-to-stone transfer and being able to retain metadata when you're moving back and forth between final cuts and smokes or shake and flame, and you know, being able to hold on to key code and time code and any, you know, that kind of stuff is a big deal, and it goes way beyond just being able to use QuickTimes or just being able to use media that lives on the stone. All that stuff is necessary, but we're taking it a lot further than that.
This FX podcast is made possible in part by GenArts, creators of the Sapphire plugins, the essential VFX toolkit for digital artists. Swing by booth SL2829 for demo of Sapphire on Autodesk systems, Avid, and After Effects, or visit www.genarts.com for more information. The podcast is also made possible in part by SohoNet, the largest high-bandwidth connector for the global entertainment industry, delivering secure, high-speed connectivity to major media companies across Europe, the U.S., and Australasia. SohoNet also provides complete technology consulting on all digital workflow issues.
Well, you know, I think the thing that most interests me about all that is just the simplicity of being able to build a reel in your Flame that says email and another one that says DVD and another one that says FTP, and when you put a clip in there, it just goes. That's kind of, you know, that's pretty interesting. You saw Stonegate, Paul, too?
Yeah, I dropped by the Tiger Technology booth and got a demo of the Stonegate 2.0, and pretty much similar WireTap functionality that we've seen from other vendors. They're creating basically virtual clips. They can be QuickTime movie clips or I think AVI as well, but they also could be virtual, like DPX or Cineon or whatever, you know, file format sequence you want, just show up all in a folder, along with they export an XML or EDL metadata into the same folder to, you know, that you can use as you see fit, and basically take those clips, drop them into whatever application. They support Mac and PC, and It looked like a really solid application.
Yeah, cool.
It's basically also been, it's this Ion connection is being resold, you know, as a companion to Fusion. So it allows Fusion and discrete products to share clips on the Stone disk array.
It's interesting there's so many people doing this. You wouldn't think that it would be that big of a market, but I guess it is.
Yeah, I mean, WireTap really has opened up a floodgate of, you know, possibilities. Yeah. As far as interchange of not only clip data but metadata between discrete products and other products.
Hey, so how about switching the subject again? We talked a little bit about plugins that we were seeing on the show floor yesterday, and there are several of them. You know, we mentioned a little bit on Sunday about the new Sapphire Sparks, and it was interesting that they're only doing those initially, again, for the Flame market, not Autodesk market. You know, you have this complaint among all the Flame users about the pricing difference between the Autodesk version and the After Effects version for essentially the same thing with, you know, until the Linux machines was, it could actually be faster in After Effects, right?
It's funny you mentioned about pricing of plugins on Sparks and stuff. I went by the Speed 6 booth today and was talking to them about the eBay.
Yeah.
And it's actually an auction.
It is?
Yeah, it's not. That's, we actually got that wrong in the podcast.
Ah.
They're going to be auctioning off, this is like a cool thing for NAB, So you'll be able to bid. I shouldn't say this because everyone will bid and it'll drive the price up and we won't be able to buy it cheap. But you can apparently buy the Speed 6. There's a pack they're selling as an NAB promo.
Well, it's funny because when I went to search to put a link in the story last night, it was I didn't find anything that said show special in it. So they just must have put one pack of each on eBay.
Yeah, from what I understand, that was the thing. And they were saying that I think last year they did it as well, and it sold for something like $7,000, $8,000 less than the retail.
Wow.
So someone got a really good deal.
I just searched for Speed 6, one word, on eBay yesterday, and that's when I found it right away. So.
Yeah, and there are only, at this point in time, one bid on the Autodesk versions, three on Fusion, none on Avid DS. Surprisingly, none on Quantel Q systems, and none on the Assimilate Scratch systems. So,
wow!
Basically, Speed 6. It's one word too when you enter it in too. That's
I was wondering what you're doing. I thought you were booking a rental car.
You know what? I was actually booking a Hertz car, and there's actually one for $79 to the Grand Canyon. So that's good. We should go that way.
Speaking of show specials, I don't know if you've already talked about the furnace special that's going on. Where right now, if you buy furnace for a discrete product, you get the entire Tinder suite thrown in, $6,400 value till the end of April. I was just by that booth yesterday.
So buy.
I think I might try to talk the powers that be at Avenue Edit to invest in furnace. I've been wanting it for a long time. It's a great package, and you know the Tinder stuff looks very useful as well. And if we can get it for free, that's a fantastic
deal.
That's
interesting.
Yeah, that's a good call. Thanks for that heads up on it.
Absolutely.
We spoke with Carl a little bit more about their new upcoming version 4 of their plugins. I mean, I've been doing a little bit of beta testing. Haven't had a lot of time to dive into them, but got his input on kind of what's going on with that.
We're pretty excited to have version 4 coming up, and our goal here is to add a lot of new effects, a lot of new toys to the package so that people using Autodesk systems will have access to these new effects. We've added about 40 new effects to the package. We've also gone back to some of the existing effects and added new parameters and new controls and tried to improve them as well. We've reacted to feedback from our customers, thanks to all of you who have given us feedback over the years. And we're pretty excited about it. We're showing it here on the show floor, and we're seem to be getting pretty good feedback about it.
So what's the schedule for the release of this and for the various platforms that you're supporting?
This is, for now, it's just for Autodesk platforms, and we're saying this quarter. We don't have an exact date set. We want to make sure to tune it and get it all the wrinkles out and get it in good shape, but we expect it to ship fairly soon.
So how's the reaction been from the beta testers? Any particular faves in the new repertoire of plugins?
Yeah, generally good reactions. I think some of the favorites would be the Z Racti Focus. So it's Racti Focus with a depth map, so it will do different amounts of defocus. You can set your focal plane and so forth. That's one of the favorites. Dinner Lace Auto probably finds your nasty pull-down patterns automatically and sets the pattern, and then it will generate progressive frames out of it so you can do effects on it, and then you can reinterlace and put it back if you want to. It's another favorite. Probably Film Damage, another one. Make your nice-looking footage all messed up, like old film, scratches, dirt, dust, and so forth, and it's quite fast. Renders nice and quick, so that's gotten some good feedback. Another one is completely kind of different is Light 3D. Which will take a normal map out of a 3D program, and so you can do your relighting during the composite stage in 2D rather than from the 3D system.
So say if you're in batch, you can kind of feed that through Sapphire and see it in context, say in action or something like that.
Right. It takes the image that's got some color to it, but it's not fully lit, and then the normal map, and you can control the lighting at that stage.
So talking about the auto deinterlace functionality, how does that actually work? Because you've got to store that information in the pattern somewhere.
Yep. Yeah, it stores the pattern in one of the Spark parameters. So you hit Find Pattern. You go to a frame that has enough motion so it can detect repeat fields versus new fields. And then you hit a button on the Spark called Find Pattern, and it will search ahead some number of frames and try to detect what the field pattern is, whether it's 3-2 or 2-3-3-2-2 or whatever. And then it saves the pattern information in one of the parameters. And then when you process, it generates the progressive frames. And then when you process again and flip to reinterlace, it'll put it back again for you.
And so then if you're bold enough to use the clip history functionality in Flame, for instance, you could actually have that tracked information along with the result clip, right, that you could reintroduce as opposed to having to worry about save it, or how does that work?
Right. You can either jot down the pattern that it's found for you, or you can just save a setup. So you save a setup of the spark and name it so you remember which one you want to go back to. Or if you totally forget, just go back to the original clip and find the pattern again. Then go and apply the spark to your affected clip, and it will switch it to reinternalize.
Have any idea on pricing or upgrade at this point in time?
We haven't priced the upgrade. No, we have decided to keep the same price for version 4, so we've added value to the package without raising the price. But we haven't priced the upgrade from version 3 to version 4 yet.
A common question from especially Flame artists out there is this disparity in price between stuff on the Autodesk platforms and stuff on the After Effects. And we've talked about that. Could you explain kind of what the difference is and why that happens?
Well, it's kind of basic business in some ways. And there's not as many Autodesk systems out there, but it takes quite a bit of work to support still, and there's hundreds of thousands of After Effects out there, so you can justify lowering the price for After Effects and hope to make up for it in volume.
Well, also the plugins, I was walking along in the aisle the first day, and I noticed a sign at the Tiffin booth for plugins again. And years ago they had them, and then they stopped selling them, and I was kind of curious about that. So I ran into Marco Pellini, who's from Digital Film Tools, 55mm Spark set. So we talked to him about they're on the Tiffin booth with a new product and repackaging of things, and they want, you know, basically they've added the Tiffin set to it. So let's he can tell us all about it.
Tiffin and Digital Film Tools have entered into a strategic partnership, and Tiffin will be the exclusive distributor of the DFX Digital Filter Suite, which is a combination of Digital Film Tools' 55mm. Digital Film Lab, as well as some of our high-end masking tools that we put out for Photoshop. So we have then, on top of that, because they're not just the old products, we've added a number of filters from Tiffin that will match the Tiffin optical filters digitally and software. So not only do we emulate Tiffin optical filters, we emulate Roscoe gels, Gamcolor gels. We have the entire Gamcolor Gobo library for adding lighting patterns to the images, in addition to Film Lab effects like bleach bypass, cross-processing, great tools for cinematographers where they can, I guess I should say before I say that, is that DFX Digital Filter Suite will be available as a standalone, Photoshop versions, After Effects, Final Cut Pro, Avid Editing Systems, and we're working on an OFX version for Toxic and Luster. So that's the basic plan, and but a cinematographer could take the standalone or the Photoshop version on set, save his files, so that when they're doing the digital intermediate for Luster, they could load up the exact same files.
Yeah, so it was good to see those filters all back. I don't think they're doing discrete plugins yet or anything like that, but a lot of applications there aren't. It's a standalone on Mac and Windows.
Oh, you noticed that. I've been holding out for the Apple phone
With the monocolor,
for 6 years now.
With the monocolor screen there, that's great.
You like that? You like the crack
in
it?
Are you being sarcastic because Paul has the oldest phone ever?
Yeah.
Wait, let me get this out so I can wow the entire crowd.
Oh, it's like the old Nokia. Very nice. If only this was a video podcast.
I like the way the half the numbers are rubbed off, so I have to memorize.
Very nice.
You know, it's all about muscle memory.
You can see we're getting tired of the show.
I know.
We're so due. But hey, one thing about Marco is, man, that guy is busy, isn't he? He's got his hands in a lot of things. And of course, he's doing the Silhouette Effects Roto Tool, which is totally cool. And we're using that as part of the VPN at FX PhD this term. Books, right? He's done the
Apple Pro Training Shake series.
Yeah, which is great.
That's awesome.
How I learned Shake from the beginning and myself starting out.
Yeah, and we use that as one of the textbooks in FXPhD. So yeah, it seems like Marco is running around doing lots and lots of cool stuff.
He's keeping busy, as they say.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to give a little note real quick, while we're wandering off topics here. Animation Magazine this month, Tal was looking at it earlier today, and he goes, wait a minute, look at this. And there was an interview with a little one, you know, like 10 questions with Tim Alexander, who's a visual effects supervisor up at ILM. And it said, what's on your iPod? And he goes, he gave him a really nice comment about the FX Guide podcasts, which I thought that was nice. So now we're full circle. Now we're mentioning on the FX Guide podcast. So I took a picture of it and stuck it on the notes for the of the article and stuck it in the notes for the story here.
Very nice. Very nice. Anything else we saw? What about Fusion? What about their Roto? We were just talking about their Roto tool stuff.
Yeah, I saw Rotation, and it looks really cool. I like that basically what they've done is they've introduced most of the tools from Fusion 5.1. So they've got the double polylines, which are quite cool. But they've also put the Ultra Kia and the Tracker in, which is quite good. So it's quite a fully featured sort of not just a Roto tool, but like a matte prep tool as well.
Yeah, that's really cool because when you're doing Roto, those tools are really useful if you're generating mats. I mean, you can envision this as a, you know, assistant or junior workstation, also just doing not just Roto but matting cleanup. I think they a cleanup station as
they
well.
They got their paint in there as well
with the paint in it.
And yeah,
it's quite interesting. And those guys have always been great and really nice, I think. And we caught up with Steve Roberts, who's the CEO of Ion, to find out about these products from them.
We've launched two new products here. One's called Rotation and the other one's called Vision. Rotation is a rotoscoping and clean plate tool that teams well with Fusion or any other film pipeline. It's been designed specifically for film pipelines, so you can do rotoscoping with Bezier and B-splines, inner and outer splines with drop-off, motion blurring splines. It's got all keying tools in there, so you can do keying of green screen and blue screen, plus a full paint system that's a vector-based paint system that can be used for clean plate, rig and wire removals, tracking marker, touch-up and everything, dust busting, etc. So it's good for the departmentalized film divisions where they need a low-cost and fast solution that'll be available to get those pieces of film through, ready to be passed on to the main compositing pipeline.
So that's great, and that's really important, especially for people who have a nice Fusion pipeline, or they don't necessarily need a Fusion pipeline, but for those, you've got that full capability or compatibility with the Fusion product. But you also have an interesting product, and it's using the same technology, but going after a different market, essentially.
Yes, that's Vision, and that's really geared towards the broadcast market, and it's got a lot of automation features in there to do motion graphics automation, and in doing that you can do graphics and targeting to various video servers and delivery methods, and produce a nice creative design and then have it automatically feed out of databases and text files, etc., and deliver a lot of different graphic systems. So you can do automated sports graphics, weather graphics, etc., with that type of product, as well as other creative things. So it's a great fit for a news station that has a good graphics department.
I thought that was kind of interesting that they're developing this broadcast tool. We were talking a little bit last night's podcast about this idea of the high-end being this very limited marketplace, and that it really seems difficult for a company to survive on its own out there. You know, you look at Shake being acquired by Apple and kind of going away. And so it's interesting that they're expanding into, you know, new markets. So hopefully we'll keep them a healthier company. You know, they're using the same core technology, so it's not as though they're rewriting everything from scratch, you know, for the broadcast stuff. Broadcast stuff is interesting, the automation and stuff like that. But hopefully it will just help them be a healthier company and not run into those kind of
things. Well, it's interesting because Maxon did something like that as well. They had the name escapes me right now, but they had like a version of their 3D animation tool, which was really designed around motion graphics. And I think it was called MoGraph. I could be wrong. And it was, in a way, a really sort of similar thing where they had taken a much broader tool, like their Cinema 4D system, and focused on certain features of it and released that as like a cheaper adjunct motion graphics tool, which is really like what Ion's done with Vision and Rotation. You know, and speaking of Rotation, I managed to spend a little bit of time with Jay Cornelius from Imagineer Systems today, and we went through a bunch of stuff in the newer and upcoming versions of Motor and Monet and Moki. And I actually worked with Jay a few years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really like the way that they're developing the system. They're really trying to cater to a lot of different systems. They're writing, at the moment, you can take Motor splines out to G-masks. You can take them out to Shake. I think it's SSF, I think, is the Shake Roto format. They said they're very keen to be offering that up. I think they're trying to go to Fusion and another system quite soon. So you can actually just write out splines rather than just having to render out mats. And they're also going to revamp some of their... they're showing a newer version of Moki than I've ever seen before, with some really cool features. And they've got like a really nice visualization of the planar tracking. So you can actually see the planes that are being tracked as grids now in Motor. And in Moki and stuff, which is a really cool thing. So you can kind of, like, when you're doing the... Because for a lot of people, the whole planar tracking thing is a new paradigm. They don't... You know, when optical flow tracking came out, people sort of had a hard time grasping it because they'd spent so much time doing pattern recognition tracking in your 2D tools. And planar tracking is this whole new sort of mentality. I remember when I learnt Moki the first time, it was just this sort of mental jump trying to figure out what actually is going on in the application. And I was fussing around with all the splines and stuff, and it really wasn't the point, because the way it solves the track is such a different way. And it's great to have them there. You can actually see how you can break an object down into planes when you're tracking it. So the example he gave was a hand, and he was saying you could have the forearm as one plane, the palm as one plane, and you could even go down and break down the fingers and the different joints in the fingers into different planes. It's a really, and the system will track it. You know, obviously with some limitations. So it was really interesting. And I just think that although they're existing in the same space, in a sense, as rotation and as silhouette, they're actually doing a very different technology. And I'd be very keen to see how that develops over time. I mean, already they've taken this core technology from Moki and split it out into like four different tools. So it looks they're going in some interesting directions as well.
I love that stuff because I think they're a really good example of that. I think the Foundry is also a really good example of taking this core research technology stuff and taking a look at new applications in our field, you know, finding out ways to help us creatively. And the Foundry's been good at that. So I think I'd love to see more of that because I don't think there's enough of that in our industry.
Yeah. I think Adobe did a very interesting thing with, their Vanishing Point tool, which is something that you talked about, which is, I don't know if anyone has seen the videos online. There is a video online showing this where basically you set up a Vanishing Point tool in CS3. I think it's the extended, or it might be in both versions of Photoshop. And you can, it's much more sophisticated than it was in previous versions of Photoshop. And you can kind of basically make a mesh in Photoshop. And then it has this amazing ability to export to 3DS, to DXF, and also to this new Vanishing Point format, which After Effects can read.
Doesn't that just strike you as crazy a little bit, though, that you've got all this stuff in Photoshop? You know, it's just great.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it
but
is.
I love it, crazy good, you know? It's just like...
Yeah, like they've embraced 3D, and all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of things that have broken out of it.
Yeah, it really makes doing photogrammetry on, you know, simple scenes with lots of planes... just insanely easy. I mean, from what I saw, they set it up so fast.
Yeah.
You export the file. I'm really curious if the 3DS file should, you know, import into other applications in addition to After Effects.
It just looks like the matte painting, like the amazing matte painting tool from hell. Yeah. Like you look at that and you go, wow, I really want to do some matte paintings and some set extensions with that tool now.
Well, I always tell people who are in school right now, want to become visual effects artists, you know, they're always interested in going out and buying like high-end video cameras. And I'm like, the first thing you should really invest in is a really good digital still camera.
Oh,
because there's just... endless possibilities.
And a copy of Photoshop.
Yeah, and like, a copy of Photoshop.
Get into those transfer modes. And
because
all stuff.
I mean, you guys are all FFI guys, but you still use Photoshop every day, right?
Every day.
And I use Photoshop every day. And
I did open it today with Rose in the room, and I felt a little inferior.
But it's, I mean, that's one application that, you know, you can use to make sort of like letterheads and little like sort of school flyers and stuff, and that people use now in the highest end feature film stuff. And it's just, it really is an amazing tool that's like the backbone of our industry. Hey?
Absolutely.
That's why for me, that was one of my, probably just in, you know, looking back at the entire show and thinking about the kind of highlights, I think the kind of convergence of, you know, the CS3 got released on Monday, the beta versions of After Effects and Premiere Pro, which by the way, we were talking about the great Clip Notes feature. And,
oh man,
Premiere
I just,
that was just like,
sorry
totally
to
cool.
spin this off, but the Clip Notes feature, in CS3 is just I'm going to do a mic thing here. It's just amazing, you know.
Thank God we were missing the Australian hype.
I know. Well, I'm sort of the surrogate mic today. So but I was so impressed by the way they've spun it. They've really put this amazing, usable, clever feature in where you can write out I think it's just called Export to Clipnotes.
Yeah, it's like a PDF file.
Exactly, and it writes a PDF or a special kind of PDF that you can then send to a client, and they can look at and read in Acrobat Reader. They don't even need the extended version, and it's like a little timeline that you can then pause, and then type in your name and type in a comment, and then resume, and then another client, another art director, something can do the same thing under a different name, and then they send the. I think it's like an XML format file back to you, and the comments pop up in the timeline, in your After Effects timeline. So it's just going to make remote client feedback stuff just, if people take it up, really, really easy.
Yeah, and especially that's, again, new to the Mac platform. We haven't had access to Premiere Pro before, so I think it's totally cool. I've always kind of salivated on looking at that over on the Windows side. Yeah.
And that's built right into After Effects now, right?
Yeah. And I think
that's where I'd
use it. Yeah.
It's kind of like an extension of what Post-it notes were for Photoshop files, but it's a really great motion Post-it note.
I know the first thing a lot of companies are going to look at that and think, I wish I could, brand my company on the PDF. I don't know if that's possible or not, but right now it's sort of a Adobe,
Adobe-looking
PDF. Because when you're sending things to clients, obviously you want
to have like a little slide on
their work.
And all that sort of stuff.
But it's really impressive.
If there's a way to do it, I'm sure someone will figure it out soon.
So you guys have any other picks of the show that you think that was just really something that stood out?
Number one thing from the show would still probably be... it's half and half. Final Cut Studio 3 and CS3. Final Cut Studio 2, and CS3 are the two BAMs. But the whole Nuke thing for me as a compositor is really, really exciting as well. So
that would be 3.
Yeah exactly. I'm really on the fence. So the 3 really big things.
I'm with you on that. It's really hard to break that down.
Yeah. I never actually got in to see the Red movie. The lines were just too long, but I was told it was really awesome. So.
Yeah, and in addition to Red, there was just so many high-end... digital acquisition cameras that were being shown. Let's not forget about the Arri D20, which has been the DALSA. The new DALSA ones look amazing. Silicon Imaging was there with their camera, which has just been recently redesigned. So I think, I've already started seeing at our company stuff coming in off of the
D20,
Genesis. We got some D20 stuff in last week. I'm not going to say film is dead. I still love film. I still love the look of it. It's going to be around for a very long time. But, I think we're going to start seeing a lot more digital acquisition. And this is probably the year that's really going to, the floodgates are going to open up in that area.
Jeff, any thoughts? What do you think is your...
The big stuff is, I'm with you on all that. Little stuff, I really want to get my hands on Motor and play with it a little bit. The demo footage they were using, I was going to say earlier, I forgot, was that tractor footage was pretty grainy.
I was kind of
looking at it going, hey, a tracker would not be happy with that too much. And I thought that was interesting. So I'm curious to see how that works. And I want to play with that Speed 6 fluids, because I think that little fire gag is something that comes up often enough that... For $1,000?
It's really interesting because a lot of people have like MyFluids or something similar in their pipeline.
Yeah, sure.
And if it's a big, complicated fluid sim, for sure. But if you're, if you're on your comp station and you want to do a little thing, throw in an element here and there, especially in like a VFX pipeline, it could be something really cool.
Yeah. I mean, little things, but I love those things at NAB.
Yeah. So you're done with it? I'm done with NAB.
I'm so done with it.
This is my first NAB, and I know it was only like 4 days, but it felt like about 14.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
People who stay all day through Thursday are just crazy, I think. Mm-hmm.
Although Thursday usually
goes out
is quiet.
Eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably the day you can get the most time.
Come out Wednesday and Thursday,
I think,
right?
The manufacturers refer to it as the day when everybody, it's competitor day. It's when you finally, all the competitors go to the other booths.
And get to see what everyone else is doing.
And it has, it's everything to do with the show and has nothing to do with the fact that you're out till 2 and 3 in the morning.
Nothing at all to do with
that. That's just you, John. We were all in bed by 10.
I still think the line will be around the red booth even tomorrow,
because
I thought it was going to die down by today, but it was still... all the way around. And
well, anyway, thanks for listening to our podcast from here, and thanks to our sponsors this year for sponsoring our podcast, because it's been just so great to have the kind of support that we needed to get these done daily. We learned last year that we couldn't stay up all night working on the editing for it.
Yeah, one thing that was weird this year, Martin from Discreet, I miss him.
Yep, the mayor missed him at the user group meeting. First user group meeting at Autodesk at Discreet without the mayor for a long, long time.
I
always liked
his
little ribs and pokes at like Carl Bass and
yeah.
and the management and so forth. But We know he's doing well. He's still in Montreal. We talk to him often. So, good friend of ours here.
Yes.
Well, I guess that's it. Thanks for listening. Again, if you have any, we'd love to hear your feedback about these podcasts, and hopefully we'll do them again next year, and maybe even, we'll see. We're taking a look at thinking about doing these at SeaGraph. So if you're interested in that, be sure to drop us a line and let us know. So, Tal, thanks for being here, man. You're great this week.
Thank you very much.
You're like the Australian voice in all our podcasts over the last couple of weeks.
It's that international flavor.
Yes, it is. And Paul, thanks. And, of course, thanks to Jimmy. Jimmy Shen, who's running the board on keyboard.
Doing the editing for us at night. All that stuff. It's been great. And Mike's probably sitting in the LAX right now waiting for his flight. The long layover.
Yeah, that sounds good. So, again, thanks for listening. And, again, we'll see you online.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.
This special NABFX podcast is made possible in part by the support of GenArts, creators of the Sapphire plugins, the essential VFX toolkit for digital artists. Swing by booth SL2829 for a demo of Sapphire on Autodesk Systems, Avid, and After Effects, or visit www.genarts.com for more information. This podcast is also made possible in part by SohoNet. SohoNet is the largest high-bandwidth connector for the global entertainment industry, delivering secure, high-speed connectivity to major media companies across Europe, the U.S., and Australasia. SohoNet also provides complete technology consulting on all digital workflow issues.